economy to mask the lost opportunities that ensue with the increase in minimum wage and indexing. You know, we can sit around and wait for the national economy to pick up and hope that we ride on its coattails, or we can take steps to make ourselves attractive, and I hope that 26-24 would be part of that solution. So thank you. I'll end with that.
Thanks.
Yeah, Mr. Wilson.
Go ahead.
The whole, of course, country, well, the world, the United States is involved in a recession that the East Coast is starting to come out of, and the West Coast, as predicted, is the slowest one to come out of. In manufacturing jobs, as the Employment Department has, and in our Economic Development Committee has talked about, has been the driver on that with the West Coast and our reliance on, particularly as we move from timber to high tech, and that really has been the biggest driver in and the ripple effect on the loss of high-paying manufacturing jobs. So isn't it just, in terms of job growth and the issues you pointed out, that this is during this time, the last 36 months, that regardless of the minimum wage, as a factor, the real driver has been the loss of manufacturing jobs?
Thank you. Senator Nelson, Senator Metzger, I don't doubt that that's a huge component, not at all. But what I'm suggesting to you is we've endured a confluence of events that have really put the nails down on what Oregon has to offer. Manufacturing is one of them. I've made several presentations to your committee where I mentioned lack of manufacturing. You've got electricity costs going through the roof. We have high health care costs. You've got a minimum wage that escalates. So I'm not in before you today saying that 26-24 is a panacea for everything that ails us, but boy, I believe it's a major contributor in conjunction with everything else you see.
Mr. Perry, I'm curious. I found this fascinating when I saw it was in the Oregonian Wednesday, and we got it in our boxes as we do from our regular updates from the Employment Department. But I don't know if you noticed this as well when they came with the first quarter statistics from the Oregon Employment Department, that we've seen continued job loss in all sectors, with one exception, and that was your industry. Mm-hmm. The food service industry had a job increase of 1,200 in the first quarter. Mm-hmm. So if all of a sudden these jobs were going to take businesses away, then why was that such a standout to the plus side in the food service industry?
Well, Senator Metzger, Chair Nelson, I don't know if you were here in my testimony when I showed you this graph. Basically, yeah, from a restaurant standpoint, we are the growth industry in the West. Actually, the Mountain is at 6.6 on average, and the West is 6.2% average job growth. But as you see, the only reason I would say we're not at 6.6 is because we've got three states with indexing that is hampering our ability to grow. We are growing some, but I would argue that we grow even more. And on the House side, a gentleman from the Jack in the Box was here, and he basically said they had six stores that were going in, and they are not building those now. Will they build them sometime down the future? I think three of them will come in eventually, but you're talking about manufacturing and construction. The Jack in the Box jobs, maybe not, you know, something that's going to bring somebody out of poverty, but those construction of those plants going off the board in the next 2 years, I think is a huge blow to those communities. And yes, we are growing, but as you look, we're growing. All three of the states that have a CPI are growing at a smaller or slighter rate than anybody else around us. We're not taking advantage of the boom in our industry because a lot of the corporate restaurants do not want to move here right now.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Second panel, Paul White, Tony Raffaello, and Pat Holt. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Please testify.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Paul White. I run the Honey Baked Ham Company in this part of the country, and I'm here speaking about the impact of the CPI on our business from our perspective. First of all, I just wanted to say that from my point of view, the business industry is pretty resilient overall. Most people, I think, believe this as well, and think that business owners will automatically absorb any additional costs and fees or taxes no matter what happens. This position is the position of the CPI yearly annual minimum wage increase. And I think people take the perspective that we're not going to worry about what happens in the economy or in the environment. That CPI adjustment, all that basically does is just say, let's not worry about it. Whatever comes, comes. I don't think that's the case from many people in my industry, in the restaurant industry. I think very, very few people live or actually live on the minimum wage. However, there are individual examples of people who, for whatever reason, don't increase, their wages don't increase, and they may move from job to job, or they may not take advantage of the training in the positions and not get pay increases. I don't deny that that is, in fact, something that happens in our industry. But what I would say is far more common in my industry, and I have been in it for many years now, are many fine individuals who get their first opportunity to work in any business. In many cases, these people may live at home, or they may be second income earners in a household, or they may be receiving a significant amount of income above the minimum wage in the form of tips. With regard to the impact on Honeybake itself, because of what has been happening in the state and most recently here with the CPI adjustment, we've made some what I would consider to be drastic adjustments in our planning and scheduling. We have in effect made the decision that we are not going to expand in this market in the form of company stores. And so we've made a conscious decision not to do that. In addition to that, we won't be doing it in the state of Washington. Also, we have taken the position that the best opportunity for growth in this market will be in the form of mail order business as opposed to in-state store locations. We've also made some pretty significant changes in our product mix. We've eliminated many items that we were making in-store or many items that we were buying from local purveyors and suppliers and have instead chosen to take products that have come from out-of-state or have been shipped in from out-of-state, either made fresh or frozen in other locations, and use that as a way to help assist in a reduction of our overall staff levels. The most significant change has been in the area of our staffing objectives, and this year, effective January, we took what amounted to about a 20% decrease in overall labor hours in all of our locations. In most cases, we try and not impact the number of jobs. It's my objective to save as many jobs as I possibly can. There is also, and attached to my report, a research that talks about this particular impact on the restaurant industry. As I say, we try not to lose any individual employees, but I have to be honest in saying that that has occurred. We've cut individual staff positions. More significantly, we have in effect cut everyone's hours, what they can work in terms of the maximum that are available to them, and that was intended so we could keep as many people on payroll as we possibly could. Again, from my point of view, not recognizing or understanding maybe some of the elements, but it seems to me that that at some point, as people are leaving our payroll, they're not paying taxes, and they are in fact becoming participants in either the state unemployment insurance program or the Oregon Health Plan. Neither of those are, from my point of view, what I want to see happen. Next is that we have also this year, because of many issues, been forced to reevaluate our benefit plan, and we've had to increase deductibles and drop coverage on the medical plan. And so many elements of, or what people are in fact earning from any CPI adjustment is being eaten up in the deductibles that they're going to be paying in those plans. One thing I've heard this from a number of people and even other speakers, they talk about that this will be good for me, that I'm going to know what my adjustment's going to be based on the minimum wage each year. I have two things to say to that. The first thing is I think that sounds great if you could also chart out the economic conditions and the environment for me. If you can't chart out my economic conditions and environment, you're not doing me a favor by telling me I have to raise my minimum wage rates. What is the driving force for me in my place is the market. The market determines what I have to pay in order to get good quality employees. And if you artificially set it significantly higher, what you're doing is you're going to cut the number of jobs that are available in my locations. In today's environment, on my restaurant side of the business, we're not seeing increasing prices. We're seeing deflation. If you look at the fast food business, which is a little more of what my business operates in, you go to the McDonald's and the Burger Kings and the Wendy's, what you're seeing are 99-cent menus. And it's driving down their profitability. It's not increasing their customer counts. And I got to tell you, it's not increasing mine. And that certainly is my problem, no one here. But I want to point out that when you're advertising a 99-cent value menu, it's pretty hard to increase your sales. It is also extremely difficult to raise your prices, which is the catch-all solution for any problem that is presented to me when I talk about the CPI adjustment. Finally, the last thing I'd like to say is that with the CPI adjustment, we're effectively taking about 20 to 30% of my margin each year. I have to, as a condition of my position and responsibilities, find a way to make up that money. I have one area that is a variable cost. I can't seem to do much to affect my utilities. I can't do much to affect my taxes. I cannot change many of the areas of the cost structure, but I can affect labor. While my industry may be demonstrating an increase in the number of in the growth in that area, it's also the easiest industry to get into. And I think you see many people coming into this industry because they're leaving others. I don't see trading into industries as a good thing. So I ask you to consider an adjustment in the CPI, eliminating that, and allowing what we see in the economy and the environment to impact the decisions you make in this area in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Tony Ruffalo. Yeah, I'll try and keep it short.
This thing is simply going to affect you.
Mr. Chair, I'm not here to either support or oppose the legislation. I've been asked by the Oregon Restaurant Association to provide a summary of the economic literature on the effects of minimum wages, and I would like to just briefly provide that for you. Quite literally, there have been dozens of studies on the effect of the minimum wage, and the results conclude that there is anywhere from a very minor effect to some fairly substantial effects that, for example, for the Oregon current minimum wage might result in as much as a 2% reduction in employment. And there are studies that find just about everything in between. I think part of the issue that you need to address is why do we find such substantial differences in the purported effect of the minimum wage on employment? And I think the answer to that is that we always have to recognize that the effect of the minimum wage is only relative to what the market wage would be. If you have a minimum wage that is below what a market clearing wage would be, the effect on employment is not expected to be noticeable, if there would be any. It's only when the minimum wage gets above the market clearing wage that you start seeing employment effects. And we see these differences both over the business cycle and geographically, for example, urban versus rural areas. We would tend to see differences in what the market clearing wage would be, and therefore differences in what the impact of the minimum wage would be. If you have a booming economy and strong growth, the minimum wage very likely would have very little impact on employment. On the other hand, if you've got a stagnant economy and an area with low labor costs on average, then the minimum wage would have a bigger impact. In order to keep it short, I'll just briefly comment on some of the other purported effects of the minimum wage. One of the arguments in favor of a minimum wage is typically that it's going to help low-income workers. The evidence on that is at best mixed. For example, you find that more than half of the recipients of minimum wages in many cases come from families in the upper half of the income distribution. Again, typically they're second or third workers in a relatively well-off family. So that in terms of the targeting of the aid, there are many other things such as the earned income tax credit that could more effectively target aid at low-income families. In effect, what you're doing with the minimum wage is providing a tax on business and then distributing the proceeds on a fairly random basis. Some of the other issues that have been raised are the questions of what happens in terms of selectivity. Again, what you typically expect is that the workers who have the least skills are the ones who are going to receive the lowest wages. And one of the ways they get jobs is by offering to work for lower wages. If you set a minimum wage and you have a large excess supply of labor, it can work against entry into the labor force for the people with the least skills. So just in summary, the economic literature basically concludes that the minimum wage does have an effect on employment, but that there is great uncertainty as to the magnitude of that effect on employment, and that it is very sensitive to the business cycle and other characteristics.
Yes. Hello. For the record, my name is Kathy LeCompte. Your notes, I believe, say Pat Holt is speaking. I'll be filling in for him this afternoon. My husband and I operate Brooks Tree Farm, a wholesale nursery just north of Salem.
Not read it. Just how does this thing affect you? No, I mean, we can read all this stuff here, but how does this thing affect you? How is it really going to bother you?
Well, I can tell you, for starters, for the very first time ever, we laid off full-time permanent employees this last year. Always before, we've had opportunities to set work aside for our workers and hold it until rainy days or slow periods, and we'd put those people to work during that period of time. For the first time ever, instead of maintaining any of our temporary employees, we not only laid off all of them, we laid off full-time permanent people also. And those people won't be getting their jobs back.
How many temporaries and how many full-time?
We employ approximately 65 temporary people and about 12 full-time people, so we've reduced that down to 9 full-time people.
You're talking about 68 people have been affected by this.
Well, some of those people would have been reduced at the end of the peak season anyway, but we would have normally carried several of those on through to a second minor peak, you know, following. So all of those temporary people for the first time lost their jobs, and an additional group of full-time people also lost their jobs.
When you talk to these workers and you tell them you're going to lay them off, what's the response?
Well, obviously, they ask if they'll be able to get a job back, you know, in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, as it's a temporary thing. And for the ones that we think we may hire back, we tell them, you know, we will when we can. But two of the people we've had to say, you won't be back. One of those men had a family, and the other one had a wife who was very ill. So it was a hard decision for us. You know, here in Oregon, you know the economic situation. You don't need me to tell you that. But we just keep believing in miracles. We keep believing that we can raise our expenses and just magically income will flow from somewhere and we'll be able to keep our workers employed. I know that you will hear much from folks that would like to tell you, the people at the bottom of the chain need consideration, and I completely agree with that. I was at the bottom of the food chain at one time. I'm sure just about everybody in the room was. Those were entry-level jobs. Minimum wage only matters if you have a job. The people that we had to lay off that aren't getting their jobs back, it doesn't matter what the wage is. The increase in the minimum wage has already had a big impact on our farm, and arbitrarily increasing those costs for no reason is going to be an enormous damage to us. Additionally, there's more to talk about here. The food crops are really the ones that will suffer. They're already in serious decline. The nursery industry is doing very well. As you see in your notes there, in fact, there's a typo I should point out. It says we did $785 million. It's actually only $685 million. But that was a new record for us, only $685 million. 80% of that went out of state. Those are badly needed new dollars that the nursery industry is bringing into Oregon. And yet the food products are in decline. They have been for some time, and they continue. Those guys are forced into finding something else that they can do, and the nursery and Christmas tree industries look real good to them. There's not enough room for everyone to come into the same line of work, and I have to ask you, quite frankly, and quite respectfully, I might add, is that really what you want? Do you really want to drive food production out of Oregon? Do you really think it's a good idea to concentrate all of the farmers in one or two high-profile or highly successful industries and see if they can manage to survive? That's not reasonable. It doesn't make sense. I would like to point out to you also that the timber industry is in serious decline, and I'd like to say how much could we use the timber tax dollars for the schools right now, or the payroll tax dollars that we should be making on those jobs.
I've always maintained that money does grow on trees. You do harvest those things, and that goes out and that helps schools and helps. I mean, I appreciate what you're saying. Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Tony, is that right? You had mentioned that, I think the words were that the effects of the minimum wage on employment was cloudy, I think at best. Would you elaborate on that a bit more?
If you look at various studies that have been done, the statistical analyses that have been done, they range from virtually no effect from one study that was done in New Jersey about 10 years ago to effects of as much as 3% of employment for a state like Oregon with current minimum wage relative to the federal minimum. There was a study that was done a couple of years ago that looked at differences in unemployment rates for the states that had a minimum wage above the federal minimum versus the states that had a minimum wage at the federal minimum. They found that the average unemployment rate in the states with the minimum wage above the federal minimum was a half a percentage point higher than the unemployment rates in the states that had that just basically followed federal minimum. So the other issue that I think is, as I mentioned, is of importance is it depends on what you're looking at. If you're looking at total employment, the effect of the minimum wage tends to be clouded. Even if you look at industries in which the wage tends to be low, there are times and there are locations where the market clearing wage is above the minimum wage that's prevailing at that time. And so the effect of the wage is in fact negligible. It really depends on the difference between the market wage and the minimum wage at that point in time. This varies both geographically and, as I mentioned, over the business cycle.
Thank you.
And this CPI, this is an urban-based CPI? Is that?
Pardon?
Is this an urban-based CPI? How would you define the CPI?
I assume that what they're talking about is the probably the Portland area consumer price index. I'm not certain.
I believe it's calculated over 80% of the population of the United States, so that would be primarily the urban centers in the eastern part of the United States.
Okay. There are quite 87 urban areas throughout the country.
So it's the national CPI.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks for coming. Speaking from the heart, I appreciate that. Okay, next panel, Paul Iverson, David Truitt, and Phil Olson. Start right ahead. If you would just not read from your testimony,
okay.
Speak from the heart, and how does this thing affect you?
Okay. Well, thank you for letting me testify. My name is Paul Iverson. I'm a family farm from the Willamette Valley here up in Woodburn. We employ about 25 full-time employees, up to 150 seasonals. Getting right down to the point, I am eliminating, as of this year, at the end of this season, I am eliminating full-time positions and 25 seasonal people that would have been hired in the non-peak time for agriculture from October to February. And those jobs are going away primarily because the cost of doing business and labor being in my cut flower business being the highest cost has reached the point where I can no longer compete. I don't compete on a local market. I compete globally. I'm competing against Canada. I'm competing against Holland. I'm competing against England, Ireland, and, of course, neighboring states. Washington is in a similar situation that I am. Up in the Skagit Valley with flower production, they had dozens of flower producers here a number of years ago. They're down to three major producers up in the Skagit Valley. So the basic concept is we are eliminating jobs, and those positions are gone, and we're trying to talk to these people and transition them into other jobs, but we're finding there isn't the jobs out there for them to go to. And it's the misconception that we have that all my jobs are low-wage jobs that I'm eliminating. My full-time people that I am eliminating have been with me, many of them for 4, 5, 6 years. They are not getting minimum wage jobs. They are losing upper-level jobs. The minimum wage price is a base price. We have an annual, in our operation, we have an annual raise program that every year we evaluate the year, and raises are based upon that. When the minimum wage jumps the percentage it did this year, and then it'll be going that percentage will be increasing dramatically in our program that we have for our employees. And so what it does is it's starting to bump the upper level people out because we can no longer afford to employ them. So the essence is we are eliminating 12 full-time and 30 seasonal people.
It's 42. Very good.
David Truitt, Truitt Brothers here in Salem. Came here 30 years ago, my brother and I, and our sales are currently about $65 million. 95% of those sales are outside the state of Oregon. We do seasonal canned fruits and vegetables, pears, beans, cherries, mushrooms in the off-season, chicken broth, 100 containers annually ship all to Taiwan, exported. Do about 150 different prepared meals for companies like ConAgra, with the Chef Boyardee, my Marie Callender Banquet. We do Jenny Craig prepared meals, meals for the prisoners of Guantanamo Bay, space shuttle, expeditions to Antarctica, home of Mount Everest, and so on. And that part has kept us alive and surviving, while the canned part has not done well. So to get to the point, what's our issue with the indexing on the minimum wage? Well, the direct impact on Truitt Brothers is about $100,000 a year. And my problem is I don't know where I'm going to achieve savings or additional revenue to offset that. Projections are that in about 10 years, the minimum wage will be in the neighborhood of $9 an hour. Do our people deserve a higher minimum wage? My value view on that is you bet that we do. We're a family firm like many of the rest of the people here. We have great people working with us. But the problem with that is we're competing directly with processors in Wisconsin, Arkansas, and New York. And they are not subject to the same rules that we are here regarding minimum wage and indexing. They are subject to the federal minimum wage, which is $5.15 an hour. So there's a $1.75 an hour difference between their lower levels and ours, and that's a huge difference. You know, we live or die on pennies an hour, and we look at $1.75. It's a major problem for us. Our food service customers like Sysco, U.S. Food Service, and the grocers like Kroger and the like could care less about our problems and our costs. There's absolutely zero empathy with that. It's price is paramount, and they'll bid out a whole year or 6 month supply on one crack. And if you're in, you're lowest, you get the business. If you don't, you're locked out for another 6 months or a year. A direct impact on us, we let go six people recently, which is really hard to do with a family firm. Many of them have been with us for 20, 25 years or more, and like my colleague to the right of me, those were not lower-paying jobs. There's mechanics and others, relatively high-paying jobs, and it's pretty tough to sit down with a guy you've been working with for 20 years and tell him that he's leaving. Those weren't layoffs. Those were terminations. So, in summary, we're not immune from the same factors that have driven all the other food, well, not all of them, but many food processors out of Salem and out of Oregon over the last 10 years. But one way that we are different from those guys is we're a family firm, and we have deep food processing roots right here in Salem, my brother and I. So we have a stake in the success of our community and the success of our company, just like the rest of the 400 employers are working with us now, going up to about 1,000 this summer. By the way, our payroll is about $12 million, all of it spent right here in Salem. One last thing you ought to know. As soon as we leave here, we have a meeting with a large company that is going to visit with us. And when you all try to set the stage for new business here in Oregon, that's certainly beneficial. But you know where the rubber really meets the road is when these guys come talk to us and want to know, what's it really like doing business here in Oregon? And what do you think I'm going to tell them? I'm going to tell them it's a great place to live, but I would look at my alternatives very, very carefully before setting up shop here. And setting up shop in this case means 600 jobs going to 900. So it's not a small business. And I don't think Salem or Oregon can afford to lose guys like this, but I got to tell them the truth. Because if they come here and it turns out otherwise, I got to live with them. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Senator Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Phil Olson. I am a farmer in the Salem area. I'll skip around on my reading here a little bit and try to speak right directly to you. This is something that's quite close to me. I understand the issue very well. I was forced into the processing business, not to my own fault. We are here, though, employing approximately 100 employees for a very short season. The vast bulk of them make up our minimum wage line sorters on our inspection belts. We compete directly, as Mr. Truitt just indicated, with Michigan Michigan. Michigan is on a federal minimum wage. When we don't sell 99-cent value meals that someone has a choice of going from one place to another, which is very important, and I understand certainly their problems and their profit margins on that. We sell container loads of things. A container, somebody from California buying 40,000 pounds of blueberries doesn't give a hoot what my costs are. I'm in the processing business because I have to be. No one could handle the volume we put through there. We're about two months away from pricing several millions of pounds of blueberries. I haven't got a clue what my costs are, or my prices are going to be. I have a pretty good clue what my costs are going to be. We cannot control this market whatsoever. We can get squeezed in a heartbeat because they don't care. A blueberry is a blueberry, and as much as we think Oregon blueberries look real pretty, if you put my blueberries in one hand and Michigan's blueberries in the other hand, and there's a cheaper, that's where they're buying them. And we have to stay in business. So I think it's very important to note that that it not only is unfair for to have an unlevel field, because I'm again with David on this, is that it's forcing us to operate on an unlevel field. It's unfair to us. It also prevents me, primarily on my farm, because we are primarily a farmer. I wouldn't be here if I weren't. But it prevents me from paying what I would call much better wages. We have a pie that we deal with, and as soon as I make that entry-level pie much larger, then I lose the ability to pay more to the people to make this a real career, which really puts the screws to me as a farmer, because I've got to jump around and find people that I can train like crazy, and they'll be with me for a few years, and then that pie that I'm forced to deal with will be forced to change. So the level playing field, I think we understand. I hope we do. It's crucial. We have to look at the barometer of healthy industry. As I indicate there, it's capital entry. I invite anyone to look and see how much capital entry has been in the food process business. It's not there. So I really plead with you. I think that we look to you to provide wisdom and guidance. It's not an easy spot to be where you're at, and I feel for you with that. But we do that. Much as we have to look after our children, you are our parents. As much as I love my two daughters, at times I have to say, we can't do that. I would have been outvoted when I had to make that statement. But I had to make that statement. And I think that's what we're asking of you. And I really look forward to, and I know you're listening to us well, and you'll put this on your equation. But when I was on school board issues, I didn't feel I was elected to be a poll taker. I was elected to provide guidance. And I trust you'll do that. Thanks for the time.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yes, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Yes.
Cold, bad one, so you might not be able to hear me very well.
I'll do my best.
I know. Everyone's keeping their distance. In the last paragraph of your written materials, you say one of the principal reasons continually mentioned in statements issued upon plant closures is Oregon's high minimum wage.
Uh-huh.
And in the previous paragraph, you indicated that the Smucker's plant had closed, and up further you indicated Agri-Pac, Chiquita Foods. Did all those plant closures indicate when they closed that it was because of Oregon's minimum wage?
It's a factor. Labor is a very large factor, and if we talk to management, what I do occasionally with those companies, it's an input to their cost. Is it the one in the person speaking at that moment that said that was the final straw? When we have an upper end of this, on a CPI inflator, I used to borrow money when I was farming in the 70s, paying 18% for my borrowed money. If we were in an inflationary period like that, which would be affecting our labor, no one wants to sit in a situation like that to subject themselves to that type of potential hammer, if you will. So, yes, I think that certainly it's a labor, and particularly entry level labor is a factor. And that's the message I hear. I don't know how to answer that.
Well, I appreciate that answer, and I just had to ask that because, as you know, Agri-Pac went into bankruptcy, and Chiquita went into bankruptcy after they bought it. So, and I'm a court reporter in bankruptcy court, and I have been tracking those cases ever since they went in.
Thanks for asking me, Agri-Pac. I was an Agri-Pac member myself.
Yeah,
and
you probably.
And so we can talk about the financials part of that. And
yeah.
I was on that list of all those growers that got in trouble on that.
Yeah, the growers really got the short end of the stick out of that one. But the reason they filed bankruptcy wasn't because of Oregon's minimum wage, and I just kind of wanted to put that on the record. But I appreciate your testimony.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Joe Galea, Mary Bashu, and Brent DeHart. We stand pretty close to time.
Hey, I ran a tight ship when you were there.
I know. Don't go to the devil.
Senator Metzger said it was because I wasn't available to ask questions.
Well, welcome. Who wants to start here?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for having me here to speak. My name is Brent DeHart. I represent the Oregon Gasoline Dealers Association. We represent the retailers on the street. We do employ a great number of entry-level employees. In our industry, the last 10 years or so, margins have continued to shrink as minimum wage has continued to increase. And unfortunately, we can't just add to those margins due to the tight competitive nature of our business. And so what happens is we lose businesses, not just jobs, but businesses. In Salem alone, we've seen in recent years 5 small gasoline dealers close up shop, and those facilities are now vacant. So in addition to some of the testimony about loss of hours, which I have some testimony about that, we also, it's going to be loss of jobs. Obviously, I have to employ, I am a small employer, by the way, I'm a retail here in the Salem market. Obviously, I still have to staff the station, but we do lose jobs as we lose businesses. So there are fewer facilities that are servicing the public as the smaller businesses go out. As my role of president of the Oregon Gasoline Dealers, I've spoken to a lot of dealers, and one of them has related to me that he's instructed for his stations that they're not going to pay any more in wages in 2003 than 2002. And for those business operations, that means fewer hours, cutback of shifts, et cetera. Again, those are lost hours, and in addition to the facilities causing a loss of jobs. In my situation, as a small business person, I found that I've already made the determination to eliminate dental benefits at my station. I do try to offer dental, health, and a retirement benefit, actually, also, for employees of responsibility. I cover less than half the number of employees that I used to for health benefits. It hurts me, actually, as a young woman today, practically in tears over her medical bills, that I cannot offer her medical insurance in times past that I could have. So medical insurance is being curtailed, dental insurance being removed, and seriously on the chopping block would be the matching benefit I have for their retirement plans. So one other thing I'd like to mention in hearing testimony in the House side is the distinction between minimum wage and livable wage. It seemed like the opponents of House Bill 2624 to the last person confused the lines between the two issues, and I believe they're both very important public policy debates, and they both need to take place. But from my perspective as a small employer, they are very distinct, and I would appreciate if we could differentiate the two between minimum wage and livable wage. When I interview a sophomore in high school for his very first job, I do not see the correlation of paying him a wage that can support a family of four. To me, those are distinct, and I'd appreciate if we could keep that in mind as you listen to the testimony. So in short, for my industry, it's the workers who are going to lose through loss of hours as we curtail the number of hours out there, the loss of jobs as we lose the number of facilities, and the loss of benefits they've cut back necessarily so. Thank you.
I have a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DeHart, I don't doubt that your costs have been rising. Everyone has increased medical costs and whatnot for their business. But you will have to agree with me, will you not, that one of the major things impacting your industry are the big box gas stations that are going in at Costco and Albertsons and other supermarkets. Would you not agree that that is impacting your industry tremendously?
Yes, it does.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Barry Bashu. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Bureau. I raise berries, flowers, pumpkins, and a lot of other things up north near Gresham. And I thank you for the opportunity today. I'm here in support of this bill. At the very least, this bill is about maintaining whatever economy we have left in Oregon, and at the most, it is about improving Oregon's economy. The 2001 reporting period showed that Oregon agriculture had an all-time high gross income of over $3.5 billion. The bad news is that the same report shows that the net profit for Oregon farmers in that same year was the lowest in over 20 years. Why? Primarily because of production expenses, labor costs, and low prices. The problem with agriculture, as most of you already know, is that agriculture cannot set its own prices. We're price takers, not price makers. And we're affected by trying to compete with states across the United States with considerably less input costs than ours with regard to labor. On my farm, my labor costs sometimes reach as high as 50% of my inputs because of the high labor-intensive nature of my crops. There's some things with my crops, since many of them are perennial crops, and sometimes it takes me as long as 12 years to get to harvest them, I can't reduce some of those input costs or I lose the crop altogether. One of the easiest and fastest ways for me to cut costs is to reduce my labor force. If I have to continue to pay more and more costs based on some kind of an artificial index without the ability to improve my profitability with that same level of index, then I have to cut labor costs in some way or another. That's usually done at the lower end of my hiring scale, people without seniority, people that don't have a vested interest or a vested time in our farm. We normally have 9 to 10 employees this time of year. We now have 6. I've only replaced 1 employee out of the 4 who have left through attrition or left during the winter work to go somewhere else. And I haven't been unable to replace that type of a labor force because of costs. The increase of 40 cents or 50 cents an hour this year, I believe it was 40 cents, has cost me already. And if I have to build in this artificial increase over the next few years, I have to start doing something about that now. I do appreciate your time on this issue. I would urge your support for it. And if the state's economy is in a state, which we believe it is, and it faces the issues you folks have to face with the budget crisis, is considerably larger but no different than the budget crisis I face on my own farm, I would ask you to keep that in mind in your deliberations on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Floyd. I'm representing 300 members from the Oregon Grocery Association. You have my testimony in front of you, and I've revised it a little bit. I understand that you want to hear directly how it impacts our industry, so I'm going to stick to that. In the testimony in front of you, I talk about 10 independent Oregon retailers that I documented information from, and I'm just going to elaborate on that point. And from that, we've concluded, I'll start from the top. JC Select Market, owned by Jim Young, he owns and operates 2 stores, and due to an increase in minimum wage, he has told me that he has been forced to cut his labor hours by 16.25%. That's down from 320 hours to 268 hours per week. Kegler Century Markets, owned by Dean Kegler, he owns and operates 2 stores. Due to Measure 25's impact, he has eliminated 3 part-time positions, and he's also considering moving his businesses to another state. C&K Markets, owned by Doug Neidefer, he operates 29 stores. His stores are in Southern Oregon, Central Oregon, and along the Oregon coast. In response to Measure 25, he will eliminate 50 seasonal jobs that he usually has during the summer months. Moving on, Rudy's Markets, owned by Rudy Dory in Bend, Oregon. He has 1 store, and he's cutting his total payroll hours per week by 25 hours. I talked to a number of Century stores, Burns, Redmond, Prineville, Bend, and also in Lapine. To make it, just to shorten things up, all of these stores are eliminating hours. They're either decreasing labor hours, eliminating positions altogether, or decreasing benefits. Then Michael Thriftway is in Roseburg, Oregon. He has 1 store. He, like the others, will eliminate 36 hours per week. Finally, Ron Brake, owner of Food for Less. He has 2 stores, Gresham and Portland. He pays a wage that is above the minimum wage, and he tries to keep that competitive advantage. To keep that competitive advantage, he will maintain the wage above minimum wage, but to do so, he's already cut 5 part-time positions and anticipates cutting more positions here in the future. And since I compiled these statistics, this was just about a month back, I talked to one more operator who runs, owns and operates a Thriftway store in Rhododendron, Oregon. And in response to Measure 25, they've decided just to eliminate all entry-level positions at that store. It's their only option to stay in business in that business climate there. So, in short, that's how it affects our industry. We feel that an escalator based on the CPI is the wrong answer. It's based on inflation. We prefer to see an escalator based on some kind of economic health or on job creation. So I urge your support of House Bill 2624. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I was just thinking about this when you were talking about your labor. There's a bill going through the legislation now about self-serve gas. You got a choice, self-serve gas, pay higher minimum wage. What's is there a relationship to what you're going to do?
Did you have to ask me a self-serve question? What is it you want to know? The self-serve...
I mean, you're going to have a choice. You're going to potentially pay higher minimum wage. It's going to be indexed. Okay, you've got a choice of self-serve or doing that. What are your bill factors you're going to look at?
I will tell you that the increase in the minimum wage has forced our industry, as a matter of fact, our brother organization, the Oregon Petroleum Markets Association, historically always anti-lifting the ban against self-serve, has flopped this year, and there's indications that our organization will go from a neutral position to a favor of self-serve because of more dealers are looking at the increases in minimum wage as the death knell, and that they'll need self-serve to survive, if that answers your question.
I've talked to my local gas group, and they're saying, you know, give me the self-serve because, you know, my labor costs are counting. So, one of the questions, I guess, maybe for the whole panel, too, is that, you know, minimum wage isn't the total thing that causes these loss of jobs. Can you weight it?
Mr. Sherry, you're correct about that, but every person that I talk to, I ask them if there were other factors, and they believe there are. However, every single person, their first response was minimum wage is either going to move them out of the state or close their doors, or they're just going to cut jobs, cut benefits, anything they have to do to stay in business a little bit.
The average margin for a gallon, the dealer's margin for a gallon of gas comprised of, about half of that is labor itself, by far the biggest chunk. And all the other factors, including debt servicing and insurance and utilities, everything else combined is the other half. So that is kind of like the state of Oregon and looking at and education. When you're cutting the budget, then 60%, that's where it's going to have to come from.
Thank you. Questions?
I have one.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Floyd? I'm looking at the testimony you provided. In the fourth paragraph down, you say OGA, state economists, and the governor believe that the consumer price index is the wrong indicator for an increase in the minimum wage. I'm not aware that the governor's taken that position. Could you point to me to some text or statement he's made that...
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I cannot give you text. This is our gauging of his opinion in a private meeting. That was our feeling.
Okay. Well, that's honest.
That's exactly what he said to us. That he felt that it was the wrong indicator, and that just like it says in the testimony, the OGA, the governor, and state economist.
Okay. I'll seek confirmation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, yes.
Barry, I had dinner with Joe a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, tell my brother to call me. So call Joe.
I'll do that.
This is great.
And we open Friday.
Okay. That's the ceremony we have now of the opponents of HBL 26. I see the representative is in here someplace. Representative Rosenbaum, please come up. Alan Lowe and Tim Nesler. Put down as a groundwork. I'm going to give you guys more than three of you, somewhere between 15 and 20 minutes for the three of the panel three. So speak from the heart. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I am Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative for Hess District 42, appearing today on behalf of those that worked to pass ballot measure 25, and I was a chief petitioner on that measure. On November 5th, voters voted to give Oregon's minimum wage workers their first increase in approximately 4 years. And I think it needs to be said that historically, Oregon has led the way with the minimum wage, and I think you will be hearing in a bit a little more about the history. But what has happened recently, and in fact since 1989, is that the legislature has really defaulted, I think, on its responsibility to address this issue. And in fact, that was the last legislative session when a bill to increase the minimum wage actually got serious consideration in either chamber. In fact, since that, the legislature has only been hearing bills to exempt people or do other things to reverse the minimum wage. And so what has happened in recent years is that voters, instead of sitting around waiting for things to change, have taken matters into their own hands. And twice now, first in 1996 and again in this last election, voters have acted when the legislature has failed to do so. So I think that the bill that you're looking at today, which is asking you to reverse something that just barely 4 months ago people said they wanted, is really flying in the face of what the electorate and what democracy would tell you to do. But beyond that, there are a lot of other good reasons to look with skepticism at this bill. And first, I would ask you to consider the workers themselves and who are these minimum wage workers that we're talking about. Well, the stereotype that you often hear about teenagers who are just working for a little extra money to buy clothes or CDs is really not the typical reality. Workers are overwhelmingly adults. 73% of them are over the age of 20. The vast majority are women. Two-thirds, in fact, are women, and many of them are supporting at least one child. In fact, one out of four are single parents. And the jobs that they're doing are really some of the most important and most difficult, most back-breaking jobs we have. They're growing our food. They're serving it to us, as you've heard. But they are also people who are taking care of our kids in daycare centers or taking care of our elderly parents in care centers and nursing homes. And I found it ironic. I was listening in my office a few minutes ago to some of the testimony about food banks, because it is also the case, as has been well publicized, that Oregon has the highest rate of hunger. And this is, in fact, Hunger Awareness Week this week, so that we saw just, I think, 2 days ago, a huge truck with 40,000 pounds of food from Albertsons out on the front steps of the Capitol. But when you think about those food banks and that emergency food assistance, and then you hear from the food banks themselves about who they're seeing. They're seeing people, 42% of the people that are coming in for that kind of help have at least one person in their family that is working at a full-time job. And many of those people, too, are these minimum wage workers that we're talking about. And if you look at the most recent Oregon benchmark study that came out from the Oregon Progress Board, they tell us that we have a poverty rate in our state of 12% that stayed constant in the 1990s, despite those boom economic times that many people benefited from. So I think this is the backdrop that you have to bear in mind when you're considering this bill. And these are the problems that voters were addressing when they voted for Measure 25, which was really, after all, a very modest increase in the minimum wage. According to the Employment Division, in the intervening 4 years since it had last gone up, the rate of inflation had been 8.8%, and the minimum wage went up only 6%. So even that increase did not really make up for the entire loss in the cost of living during that time. And you have heard arguments in the last hour about reasons to reverse this cost of living increase, but I would just suggest to you that these are the same arguments that we hear in good times or in bad, no matter what the circumstances are and no matter what the facts are. And these predictions of doom and gloom that we have heard every time simply haven't come to pass. And so I think it really is incumbent on us to look at the facts when we're evaluating this. We're not asking you to just consider emotion, although we think there are some compelling
compelling emotional and personal arguments against this bill. But ultimately, what it comes down to is that no one who works full-time in the state of Oregon should be living in poverty, should be struggling to put food on the table for their kids or a roof over their heads. That's what voters were addressing when they passed this measure. The measure was very clear. I have a copy of it in my file, and it was clearly stated in the ballot title that it was to increase for inflation in future years. So there was no doubt in people's minds what they were voting for. We ask you to stand with the voters of Oregon and with the workers of Oregon, and we ask you to reject this bill. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I appear today as legislative advocate for the low-income Oregonians who are served by the Oregon Law Center. I also appear, though, as an advocate for representative deliberative democracy and an advocate for direct democracy when the representative structure fails to be responsive. And Diane has alluded to the fact that Oregon has been a leader in the minimum wage for a long time. And the first time it was a result of deliberative representative democracy at work in this building, 1913. When we had the first such law in this country. And it was passed because of documentation, which was prepared by Caroline Gleason, and she later became Sister Miriam Teresa. She had done some extensive work on sweatshops, and that led to that initial action. Now I'd like to talk about some more recent history in the minimum wage. I recall that in about 1972, the minimum wage actually allowed folks to be nearer at the federal poverty level. And then we began to see a gradual decrease in the buying power for those on the minimum wage. And it did not receive attention in this building. It was a time when it was suggested we ought to look to the federal government. Well, after the 87 session, a number of us who were in activities were service organizations, all types of things within that whole social service network, where we began to see that there was a real correlation between the lack of purchasing power, buying power by working Oregonians, and their then being present at some of our agencies for help. I remember I was volunteering at a food pantry, and took me a while to figure out that we had our greatest demand in the middle of the month and then at the end. Because folks who were getting paid twice a month in those low-paying jobs were having to supplement the nutrition for their families by coming in. And these were families, and we began to see an increasing number. So there were a number of us who began to meet. Sometimes those meetings started at 7, sometimes at 7:30, sometimes at 8. But they were on Monday morning, and we met for a year. And reason it was Monday, that was a day when none of us had conflicts. And we began to look at what we might be able to do to raise the minimum wage. I recall we worked very closely with an interim committee that was functioning in this body. We put together a proposal. We worked across the state. So by the time we entered the legislative session in 89, we had a bill number which was the same as the minimum wage, and that was Senate Bill 335, and this was my first button related to the minimum wage. And again, we worked in this body, we worked in the Senate Labor Committee, where there were the bill didn't come out quite the same as we introduced it, but it was when we really had work sessions and heard from a lot of folks. We added farm workers to the bill, and we ended up passing then an increase in the minimum wage from $3.35 to $4.75. And again, I would say it was representative democracy, because we had large groups of folks coming from all over the state in support of that bill. Well, then following that, we began to, and I'm not sure, I think that one was defend the minimum wage. As Diane said, we have had a series of things, and so I found defend the minimum wage. I found protect the minimum wage, and this one, I guess, was raise the minimum wage. But we ended up then, because the only action here was to reverse, or at least it was never reversed, but it was considered. Then we went to the ballot again. And one of the things that we did when we went to the ballot again in 96 was, rather than indexing, and by the way, I was chief petitioner, we established then some steps, $5.50 in 97, $6 in 98, and then $6.50 in 99. But I have very vivid memories of some of the arguments I heard today that really, I would say, are contradictory, because those who opposed our bill at that, or our initiative at that time, talked about the dramatic increases that 50 cents an hour. First we went from 475 to 550, but then the 50 cents, the two 50 cent increases, they found too much. And so I would say that what we did then in 2001, when Representative Diane Rosenbaum and others introduced a bill to establish indexing, was we were trying to respond to those who are our critics, that it was difficult for them in doing business plans to have significant jumps. Well, we had never been successful in having it dealt in this body to make it gradual, really gradual. So that was why we went to indexing. And I have with me voters' pamphlet, and as Diane said, we were very explicit in the ballot title. Increases Oregon minimum wage to $6.90 in 2003. Increases for inflation in future years. And I have highlighted through, the explanatory statement, which was signed, as you, that is the one that is put together by the Secretary of State, appoints a committee. And so it had both the those folks who are in favor and opposed. And again, it says in two different lines that current law does not adjust the minimum hourly wage for inflation, but then it says the measure requires the minimum hourly wage to be adjusted annually for inflation. Those of us who submitted our individual arguments, we did the same thing. We were very explicit about what this bill was going to do. And actually, in a couple of the arguments in opposition, they also mentioned this. So there was no cover-up of the indexing in any of the campaign statements or the campaign literature that we used. And so I would suggest to you that really, in respecting indexing, one, you're respecting the will of the voters, because they were very well informed about what was being presented. You're also really honoring, in my judgment, the historic requests that have been here from the agriculture industry, from the hospitality groups, from some of the retail, because they again were saying, through the years that for their business planning, it made sense to do something on a gradual basis. And so that's why the final pin we had was Oregon needs a raise, because we really did believe and continue to believe that no one working full-time should have to live in poverty. We now in Oregon receive over $1 million a day in food stamps into this state because of the low wages that many are experiencing. I'm proud of the outreach that has gained us that access. I'm not proud of the necessity for working Oregonians to have to seek help. Again, I would say that the bill that was passed this by the voters this last time really is honoring where Oregon has been and where Oregon needs to be in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and appearing in opposition to House Bill 2624. As you heard, this is Hunger Awareness Week, a good time to recognize that when it comes to fighting poverty, overcoming hunger, and promoting work and sustaining families, that there's no law or policy more important to our state than one that sets our minimum wage. This is a standard we've established to make sure that workers aren't forced to live in poverty, that working for a living means just that, working for a living, not working to go hungry, or working to go homeless, or working to go deeper in debt. Amazingly, when you think of it, that purpose remains all the more compelling today, at a time when we've been shamed by the highest hunger rate in the nation, and when the national minimum wage has become a prescription for poverty. You heard some of the history from Ellen Lowe about the actions over the years to establish the minimum wage we have now. I want to call your attention to the last session also, when you passed a new law, House Bill 2744 in the 2001 session, promoted by many of the same groups who are promoting this bill to eliminate the cost of living adjustment on the minimum wage, that banned minimum wage laws at the local level on the theory that we should have a minimum wage that should be good enough statewide for all Oregonians. Well, that's what we established. That's what the voters established last November with Measure 25. We've reset the minimum wage back almost to that modest level of 1999. It applies to all workers statewide, and it reaffirms the principle that every job should pay enough to keep a worker out of poverty. The annual cost of living adjustment provided in Measure 25 is likely to produce annual increases of, at current rates of inflation, 10 to 15 cents per hour, about a dollar a day, or $4 to $6 a week. And that extra money can make a big difference to a poor family struggling to buy bread or milk. But it hardly represents a major cost of business for employers. Yes, some of those employers are struggling, but so are many working families. And the factors that make these tough times for businesses have a lot more to do with costs that have risen far beyond the rate of inflation, such as electricity costs, than with modest increases of 2% to 3% for workers' pay. We think of the minimum wage as a floor, but the inflation formula, politically, I would assert, really represents a ceiling that we've now put in place, set at no more than the increase in the cost of living for minimum wage workers, and guaranteeing moderate cost increases that businesses can anticipate and afford in the future. Just a couple of points, because I'm not going to read all the written testimony I've submitted. Obviously, the minimum wage and annual adjustments to keep up with the cost of living is critically important to working families. It's also, we believe, a tonic for our economy, because it helps to boost and maintain consumer spending. Dollar for dollar, there's no greater stimulus for consumer spending than increased wages for low-wage workers who spend all of their paychecks every week in our communities, in the retail sector of our communities, and help to maintain spending and the flow and the flow of purchasing and economic activity in those communities. We also point out that the employers who testified previously in favor of this bill have talked a lot about the challenges of competition, the costs of competition, but they fail to make the case for why competitive forces should be allowed to dictate poverty wages. That's the basic policy that the minimum wage represents in this state, that however you compete as a business, and it's important to be competitive, and there are a lot of costs of doing business that should be taken into account. There's a bottom line here. There's a floor. You shouldn't compete by paying poverty wages to your workers. We now have a minimum wage that keeps workers out of poverty and a formula to make sure they don't fall back into poverty in the future. It's not a living wage, but it is a minimum wage, all the more important. And all you have to do is leave it alone, and we'll keep what the voters have said they want as a policy of this state, a minimum wage that at the very least means no worker will be left behind when it comes to feeding and supporting a family. Thank you.
Questions?
I do. And now, if any of you are qualified to answer these, but so I don't want all three of you, just in the interest of your other panelists, to keep on time. But I do have a few things. As I was asking the other panelists, I'd like to ask you some things as well. We talk about the will of the voters, which is a very, very important issue. However, that seems to fluctuate depending on the issue. I mean, we're talking in this legislature about overturning Measure 5, which was a voter-approved initiative. We altered Measure 88 before it ever took effect in this legislature just a few months ago. So I'm just curious, somebody give me an idea why this is different than that in terms of looking at changing the will of the voters when we have had a history of doing that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, if you were to try to change Measure 5, you'd have to go back to the voters to do that. When it comes to measure, if you allude to the example of Measure 88, that was approved by the voters, but it wasn't initiated by the people.
That's true.
It was referred to you. I can't think of another example where you've had an initiative, a proposal initiated by the voters that you've tampered with or repealed. You've attempted to send some back out. In each case, I think you've had your hand slapped for doing that by the voters. I'm thinking of the death with dignity measure. So we're asking you to respect a measure which came to you from the voters through the initiative process and was approved by the voters. Its margin of victory, what, 2.6%? I think most of you, when you're running for office, declare victory with margins of 2.6%. It is an effective majority. It represents the will of the voters.
And I'll take the U that you had with the little Y on that.
And Mr.
I don't believe I participated in that. But I just want to ask another question. Maybe, Diane, you could answer this one then. Ellen was making the comment that the people, when they voted on this, really understood what they were voting, and you articulated some of the things in the measure. And I know, Representative, you were in the legislature in 99 as well, together, when we had the victims' rights legislation, and the argument was, from many that, people knew what they were voting on, but they had no choice. They either had to vote for the whole package, but that doesn't necessarily mean they would have voted for each one individually. And so we broke those out. There was eight of them. One we found was unconstitutional. So we sent the other seven out to the voters to ask them to vote on these separately. And as it turned out, they voted for four and rejected three. That given the choice to vote separately, they voted differently. And I'd ask you then, similar to what I asked Tim on the other question, why would this be different than saying, okay, let's ask the voters whether they really voted for this because they really wanted the 690 or they wanted the CPI?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzger, I think that's an excellent point because, you know, if people want to refer this to the voters again, that would be one thing. That's not what this bill is asking you to do, though. So I think, you know, your example shows that people are very capable of discerning and reading measures and evaluating them. But this measure, you know, unlike the one that you referred to, which was complicated, which was thrown out by the courts because it had multiple changes that were considered not closely related, these were changes that were extremely simple, easy to understand, closely related, and as Ellen talked about, amply talked about in the ballot title, the explanatory statement, and in virtually every voter's pamphlet argument. So I think for somebody to argue to you that voters just didn't understand this really doesn't pass the red face test. And we're not asking voters, we're asking legislators to say something in opposition to what voters have already said.
Thank you.
I'll follow up on page 28. That's not another tax increase. Proposal to the voters. Voters have spoken.
Well, voters may have spoken on one proposal, but there certainly are there's no shortage of other proposals that we could be asking their opinion on.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that, since I probably was the most visible voice in trying to support the work of this or the previous legislature in what became Measure 28. That was not drafted by the people. It was late evening compromises, as you will recall. And so I would suggest that maybe rather than judging the will of the voters on increasing taxes by Measure 28, what you really should be doing is looking at developing a process in this body where you really could, in a very open way, craft a measure that for services where all of us would have an opportunity to participate. And as one of those who is here for every day, was it 18 days, there really were not those opportunities. So I tried hard. Some of your fellow legislators were on the other side of the fence. I would hate to use Measure 28 as any kind of measuring stick for how voters really feel about how Oregon should govern and how Oregon should pay for it. Next time, let's have all of us work on a revision that works.
What's your position then on, you're saying basically the minimum wage is going to be the thing that's going to solve the problems, or maybe not solve them. But in the timber industry, you've lost 25,000 jobs in the last 10 years, plus all the peripheral spinoff jobs. In the high-tech industry, we had some testimony in Senator Metzger's Transportation Committee where you've had people that have not been able to find a job for 16 months. So, the minimum wage isn't the cure-all to everything. Would that be a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, hardly. That's why it's the minimum wage. But it is the floor that's set for employment in this state for the reasons I've already stated. And I think what you're calling attention to are other factors, including global market factors and national market factors, which have taken a real toll, they have, on a lot of the best jobs in Oregon. We care about jobs. We care about making all jobs good jobs. But when it comes to the minimum wage, what we're saying is at least establish this level so we're making sure that these jobs aren't poverty-level jobs. We're going to continue working with you on the transportation package and on other ideas we have to both improve our economic standing and get people back to work. And as we do that, we're going to continue to remind you that we think a minimum wage ought to be in place. It's not a poverty wage.
I think everybody agrees there should be a minimum wage, but I mean, testimony from some of these folks is there's potential loss of over 100 jobs already. How do you explain that power before us?
I've heard the testimony, Senator, and I think we should look at those situations where you're having arguments made by representatives of businesses who are retailers, in-state retailers, who primarily have a captive market, whether they're selling gasoline or selling restaurant meals. I don't think that what we're talking about here is nearly as severe as they think when it comes to the minimum wage. People are going to continue to put gas in their cars and continue to dine out, even if a small amount of cost is passed along.
Farmers too.
I think the other category we need to look at differently are businesses which rely on exporting their products. And I would admit that agriculture is certainly that sector. There we need to look at our competitive standing vis-a-vis agriculture or other comparable sectors of the economy in other states. And I would just remind you of something we've testified to in other committees, and that is we do have the lowest business tax burden in Oregon now of all 11 Western states. It's not just labor costs that go into the equation here, but a lot of other costs.
Pretty good deal.
Yeah, and it helps in terms of making our state competitive. But do we choose to compete by paying lower wages and allowing poverty wages, or do we choose to compete in other ways? We're urging you not to encourage competition.
Does your organization support a rollback or change of the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Clean Air Act?
We have actually, I think, taken a responsible middle ground on the forest plan. We're looking at the fact that the Clinton Forest Plan never delivered the jobs. and that includes the amount of harvest that was promised. We're looking at the new proposals. Of course it has. And so we're looking at striking the right balance there, but we don't think that the Clinton Forest Plan ever did what it was supposed to do. As a result, we lost jobs and suffered from less of a harvest than would have been responsible. And we're looking for ways to strike that balance in that sector.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
Go ahead, question. Oh, thank you. Those are some very good questions, Mr. Chair. And I found it kind of interesting. It took me back to my college philosophy class or my elementary logic class, if A, then B, then C, because one of the claims that the chair made was, is that the same argument you can use to the voters for failing ballot measure 28, we wouldn't want to send something back out. And Ms. Lowe's comment was very right on, that we had referred measure 28 out, but the minimum wage ballot measure was something that you did. You collected signatures at the grassroots level, and Representative Rosenbaum, you can tell me how many signatures you collected because you were sort of in charge of that. And would you share how many Oregonians signed that petition?
I think it was somewhere around 90,000 or 92,000 signatures. I can't remember the exact number, but that's pretty close. And I also, sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, want to point out we only did that after we put a bill in to do essentially the same thing and were unable to get even a serious consideration of it in this body. And so we didn't do that as our first choice. We brought it here. But failing that, we took it directly to the people. And finally, I just want to point out, you know, for things like ballot measure 5 that somebody mentioned, people have started putting things in the Constitution for exactly this reason, that they're afraid of having them unravel. And we didn't do that. And we didn't do that because we don't believe that the Constitution is, you know, a bulletin board that should be covered with post-it notes of things that really belong in statute. And I would think, you know, that you would support our willingness to work with the legislature to make things so that they are workable, but not to take advantage of that.
And Mr. Chair, sure. I have two more questions. And Representative Rosenbaum is leading me right into my next one. The argument that voters didn't know what they were voting for is a little bit specious, because you've made it very clear that it was a very clearly stated ballot measure. I want to ask you, any of you, I remember getting a statement or some kind of flyer shortly after session began about the broad support that ballot measure received, that it wasn't just a matter of the people in the valley voting for that. Maybe you can respond to that. But the other question was, I think sometimes Oregon voters, they know what they're voting on, but they don't always know what the intended consequences are, or the unintended consequences, let me put it that way. So ballot measure 5 certainly was in 1990, and a lot of things have happened since then, and people are rethinking that. But we've just passed this ballot measure. I don't think there are any unintended consequences that people didn't see, given the explanation in the voter's pamphlet. But could you please tell me how widespread the vote was on this measure?
I don't have the exact figures, but it passed in the majority of Senate districts. I know that is true for a fact. And I believe it passed in 30 of our 60 House districts.
Yeah. And 17 counties.
And 17 counties. And that included, you know, heavily tourism-dependent counties at the coast where the support was very clear. So it wasn't just a case of the metropolitan area imposing something on the rest of the state.
Okay, and my final question, Mr. Chair. And it was actually comes off of something Mr. Chair said, that the minimum wage is not the cure-all. And I think you agree. I think you'd also agree that you can't say that the minimum wage is the cause for Oregon's high unemployment as the sole factor. I think one of the questions I asked the gasoline dealers was, one of the reasons their industry is having trouble is because of the big box gasoline stores that are going in. In fact, a lobbyist for the Capital Club used to own some gas stations in Eugene, and he sold them. He got rid of them because he couldn't compete with the big box stores anymore. So there are broader issues than just wage issues in terms of high unemployment and cost to employers. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I would say it's not a panacea, but it's also not a Pandora's box that you can blame for all of the evils that we're facing. And, in fact, there was a bill in a committee that I serve on the other side of the building to address just the problem with the big box stores that you just mentioned. So, you know, I think it's convenient to use this to blame everything, but it's not a solution to everything. It's not the cause of all of our problems.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Senator Messner.
I just have one question. Tim, I just wanted to follow up on a comment you were making about some of our exports. And, you know, what do I say to the folks in my district, which are Mr. Bashu is in my district, raspberry grower, makes some of the best raspberries around. I've got fruit tree growers. I've got Christmas tree growers. And what do I say to those who are, it's pointed out, you know, are price takers? Mr. Bashu can't get the price of raspberry. And they come in from Chile. We have hardly any strawberries anymore. He'd love to raise the prices. He has no choice to do that. He pays whatever it is paid at the processing plant, if it's $2.33, or if they get the pear price and they say, you know, for 2 3/4 inch pears, this is what the price is, and which has been going down because the pears now coming over in, from China. So what do you tell them about, you know, I'd love to pay wherever I can, and but I can't compete, and I have no choice because now the international market is being flooded in, and you're allowing people who have substandard environmental and other laws sell product that puts me out of business. Could you help me with that response a little bit?
Mr. Chair and Senator, first of all, I think your question contains some of the answer. The minimum wage is not the problem. We've had changes in our trade laws. We have foreign competition, which has exacerbated the problems. An extra 10 or 15 cents per hour for these workers, just keeping up with inflation, shouldn't be a backbreaking cost for business, which should continue, we believe, to compete by the quality of product. We believe a brand Oregon approach to the high quality products we produce here in the agricultural sector is one approach which will help. But and also, let's look at the record of productivity in the agricultural sector as well as in other sectors, where we continue to get a great output per worker. True, that's sometimes because of mechanization, and it's true that in some industries that means fewer jobs. But that's a trend we're adjusting to all the time in our economy and all kinds of occupations, that the workers are working harder and smarter and longer, and we're getting greater output. The Federal Reserve's most recent data shows 4% productivity increases annualized in the last quarter. You know, if the minimum wage were adjusted for productivity every year, we'd see a lot higher increases than we're going to see under cost of living. So it's a dynamic economy. We're always trying to compete. We're saying there should be a floor on competition when it comes to paying a poverty wage, but there are other ways in which I think our industries can compete effectively on the quality of the product and how cost effective they are in producing it.
Okay. Thank you. Everybody would like to. People are getting $20 and $30 an hour wage. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. We'd love to all have that. There's just a lot of factors involved in it.
Let's see if we're going to just come up and make that brief statement.
Okay. Joe Gillen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Joe Gillen with the Oregon Grocery Association, and before you have shock and awe, I'm not here in opposition to the bill. Senator Walker asked me to come in and clarify our testimony by Dan Floyd earlier, and I think that's a fair thing to do. I think we may have confused the committee on his comment. His comment was that in a conversation with the Oregon Small Business Coalition, there were 20 lobbyists in the room, the governor does not support House Bill 2624. But he doesn't think the CPI indicator is the right indicator. It doesn't mean he supports the bill or the repeal of it or going against what Representative Rosenbaum was arguing on her behalf of going against the voters' will. But he does not believe the CPI is the right indicator. So does that kind of, there's two different issues there.
Yes, that clarifies it. Thank you for coming back.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Appreciate that. Joseph McKinney, Jill Brunell, and Tara Lynn. Is it Tyra?
Sure.
Welcome. because we ran a little long on that last panel, so if you could speak from the heart and everything we have, if you have written testimony, we'll have an opportunity to listen to you speaking.
I think so. Good afternoon. My name is Joseph McKinney, and I'm the president of Oregon Roads, where we originate loans, primarily based on vehicles and equipment. 70% of our clients are businesses, most based in Eugene, and our volume is between $7 and $10 million annually. I'm here today to address the impact the minimum wage has on our local economy. A healthy economy requires a balance among its various economic classes. A home buyer cannot move up to a better home unless someone else is able to qualify to either purchase or rent their existing home. My clients cannot afford to trade up in vehicle unless there is a demand for their trade-in by qualified candidates. To have a healthy marketplace requires a healthy economic dynamic. My experience in finance on the local level validates the trickle-up economic model. My electrical contractors are not leasing new vans because the restaurant they just remodeled is not paying their bill because working people are not going out to eat. I've supported an increase in the minimum wage because the standards in our community are too low and it shows. I'm not addressing the political or philosophical questions of a minimum wage. I'm looking at it as a small but necessary economic stimulus package. And when I hear how few dollars staff estimates this to cost, I say shame on us for hesitating. Ladies and gentlemen, this is chump change. Every penny that finds its way into a worker's paycheck is funneled back into our local economy, where it is spent again and again. Consumer spending stimulates business-to-business spending. It's all connected. We're all connected. That's the dynamic I'm talking about. And that is necessary for a local, healthy economy. I respectfully suggest that you oppose HB 2624 because an indexed minimum wage would benefit a broad spectrum of economic classes in Oregon.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jill Burnell. Due to a scheduling conflict, Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner is unable to attend today's hearing, and he asked that I attend the hearing on his behalf and testify in opposition to House Bill 2624. With Oregon leading the nation in unemployment and hunger rates, the commissioner believes that this modest increase, which was approved by voters in November and took effect in January, is reasonable for several reasons. First, it fairly addresses the needs of working families living in poverty. It promotes purchasing power, and it offers businesses the ability to budget more effectively and accurately for increases in responses to rising costs. And the commissioner asked that I just briefly, and I do mean briefly, expand on those 3 points. First, unlike skyrocketing energy prices and healthcare costs, which drastically and unexpectedly increase the cost of business, indexing provides small and predictable increases for businesses. Second, we live in a consumer-based economy, and businesses are dependent on the purchasing power of minimum wage workers. When the minimum wage increases, businesses experience higher profits because workers have more money to spend. Next, low-wage workers pump every dollar of their paychecks into the local economy by spending their money in their neighborhood stores, local pharmacies, and corner markets. And they spend that money on food, medicine, and clothing for their children. And finally, the commissioner is fully aware that raising the minimum wage with the annual adjustment will by no means eradicate poverty across the state, but it will help tens of thousands of low-wage working families put food on the table, pay rent, and cover basic essentials. He believes that without this annual adjustment, these families will be forced to rely on food banks once again, whose supplies are quickly diminishing, churches, and vital social services. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tyra Lynn. I have been working for minimum wage or a little bit more for more than 10 years now in the food service, childcare, and retail industries. I support myself and my 3 children and 16-year-old sister. I'm fortunate to not have to pay for childcare while I go to work because I do have a sister to do that for me. I also would like to point out that the recent increase in the minimum wage has allowed me to do things such as put my 8-year-old child in baseball for the season, extracurricular activities such as science programs after school, which I otherwise would not be able to afford. Yet I'm still back to where I am spending 90% of my income on my housing costs every month and going to food banks every month for food boxes after my food stamps run out. I don't have enough money to live. I just don't have enough money to live. And the price of milk is going to go up within the year, another 30 cents a gallon. You know, my energy costs are going to go up. My rent could possibly go up. What am I going to do then without the minimum wage going up? That's all. Thank you.
Just one. Ms. Lynn, do you take advantage of the earned income credit?
Yes, I do.
That's great. There's a lot of folks out there who can and don't.
Yeah, unfortunately, my earned income credit is paying off back school loans. So,
but even with the earned income credit, which Congress started in the 70s, that's still not enough to help you make all your ends meet.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming down. Thank you. Next panel, we have Cassandra Garrison, Jeff Thompson, and Robert Castaneda. I'm sorry about that. Yeah, we have some other folks who want to testify. Speak from the heart. If you have written testimony, we can get them in. So. Yes, please start.
Good afternoon. My name is Cassandra Garrison. Good afternoon, committee members and Chair Nelson. My name is Cassandra Garrison. I'm the public policy manager of the Oregon Food Bank. And as you know, this week is Hunger Awareness Week. And I'm just really glad to be able to come here today to talk to you about the situation. Hunger is an income problem. I've pretty much decided that we have seen our numbers double in the last 5 years. The mission of the Oregon Food Bank is to end hunger and its root causes. And I've been beginning to see that the issue around hunger and poverty in the state is because people can't get access to education and training to be able to increase their monthly income. I've asked the staff to hand out to you our stat sheet from the Oregon Food Bank and then also My Voices Project. Last year we traveled statewide and saw families and asked them questions about education, health care, employment, housing, and their advice to their legislators. And what we found is that a lot of people are not able to meet their monthly expenses. They're being subsidized through the food stamp program, the Oregon Health Plan, employment-related daycare programs. They're subsidized in state and federal dollars. And the majority of the people coming to the food bank are very low income. They live below the federal poverty guidelines. One of the statistics that I just want to give you to get your head around is, according to the Multnomah County Commission on Children and Families, which I'm part of the Poverty Advisory Committee for, 64% of the families that live within the federal poverty guidelines in the state of Oregon work full-time. That's just an amazing fact. And so I just want you to really think about that. We serve 72,000 unduplicated food boxes. This is our little stat sheet. And 72,000 emergency food boxes, unduplicated, went out of our agency. And 60,000 per month are children being fed. 40% of those receiving emergency food boxes are children. I just wanted to also talk to you about the Voices Project. Was it urban-rural? We traveled to all different areas of the state, and what we found is that it wasn't much different in that when you moved out of their rural areas, we had transportation and housing issues and electrical costs, just like people inside the city were dealing with. The continual emotional stress and physical stress on these families is immense, and we see families who are not covered by any kind of medical coverage at all, and they're in low-wage jobs with no medical coverage, and so they have fixed costs. When we had these hearings before, we would hear, well, I have these fixed costs by the Restaurant Association and the agribusinesses, but so do low-income families have fixed costs. They have no control over their housing, their transportation costs, their electric bills. There's no bill collector for food, so that's where we've really seen the numbers climb, is people coming to the food box agencies for the very first time. We actually have seen in the last 10% in the last year of people coming with it to the food box agencies, just another 10% on top of the almost 33% that we've seen. There are fixed costs for families. There's taxes, child care, medical costs, transportation, rent, and electric. And I want to acknowledge that some of the people who donate to the Oregon Food Bank, be it wholesalers, retailers, government sources, and individuals, we depend on agribusiness to help us. We depend on the Restaurant Association to give us donations. We value that. That's part of our collaborative network that comes to us. But also, we have to say that we supported the minimum wage because we see that the majority of the people coming to get emergency food boxes are people who were at one point making $6.50 an hour. No, minimum wage isn't going to be the cure-all. But I can also tell you that any assistance to stabilize these families is better than none. And I want to say that the added security for these families makes Oregon a much better place to live. Concessions have to be made. We all have to make concessions, especially given the state of the business community and the economics as a whole across the state. We're all struggling in this economic downturn, but these are families that live on the edge. Just one thing, one little thing, not getting your child care paid, not getting your transportation costs paid, maybe your hours get cut, will cause a family to lose their housing, and unhoused families find it very difficult to continue to work. Concessions need to be made, but I'm asking you to not make the concessions on the backs of the poor families in the state. Thank you.
Some of the committee members are going to have to leave at 3 o'clock if there's other committees, but we'll keep the committee going, at least in subcommittees, so people have an opportunity to testify. So,
okay.
People walk up and go, there's other obligations there. They have other committee members. They have community meetings that they've got to go to.
Chair Nelson, committee members, thank you for having me here this afternoon. My name is Jeff Thompson. I'm a labor economist and policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and we do research and analysis of economic issues and state policies that impact low- and middle-income Oregonians. And toward that end, our interest in the minimum wage in the state is whether or not increases have delivered the promised wage gains to Oregon workers, and if indeed whether or not those increases have triggered job losses. I handed out a couple of pieces. It's not my written testimony. It's a copy of a recent report we did and an executive summary of another recent report come out on April 24th. Briefly, the summary of our research in the several reports we've done over the last several years is that indeed minimum wage increases have delivered the promised wage gains to workers, but the feared job losses have not materialized. The wage increases have been witnessed in the increases in inflation-adjusted earnings seen by the lowest 10th percentile of workers in Oregon were falling relative to inflation up through 1996, and then along with the increases in 1997, 98, and 99, low-income, low-wage workers in Oregon did see an increase. Also, we can measure the increases when we look at the earnings of households, workers leaving welfare and returning to the world of work, and in fact, the wages of welfare leavers entering the world of work were falling up through the fourth quarter of 1996, and with each of the increases in 97, 98, and 99 spiked up and saw increases, and then when the increases stopped in the year 2000, wages again began to decline. We saw that for the 10th percentile of workers as well. On the front of job losses, as previous testimony was given, the state of the academic debate on the impact of minimum wage increases on job losses is quite messy. There is some research which indicates that minimum wage increases actually increase the number of jobs in our economy. Other jobs find that increases, in fact, cause job losses, while other
literature finds that there is no impact. There has been a trend over time that more recent research has been finding smaller and no impacts, and as economist Jared Bernstein recently wrote, at this point I think it is fair to say that the debate over the purported job loss effect is a debate over whether this effect is slightly below zero or at zero. While this debate may be an important one among economic statisticians, from the perspective of policymakers, it is a distinction without a difference. And indeed, in the period following our previous increase, the period which we have data for, we see that both the number of establishments and employment in Oregon's eating and drinking facilities, the particular sector that is most people view as most susceptible to changes in the minimum wage, that employment increased from 101,800 jobs in 1996 to 107,500 jobs in 2000. The number of restaurants also growing from 6,300 to 6,800 over that same period of time. In addition, if we would, in a scenario that's being discussed where we would expect to find job loss due to the minimum wage, we would expect to see that young workers with little education would have a harder time finding a job. What we saw instead is that young workers with little education actually saw their likelihood of finding a job increase. And so the idea that the minimum wage caused job losses is hard to support when the workers who were supposed to have been hurt have a better chance of finding a job after the fact. In addition, one of the things that people look at when they see employment trends in that same period of time is that restaurants grew slower than the rest of the economy in the late 1990s, and they attribute that fact to the minimum wage, when in reality is that's not the case. What we see in the restaurant industry and other industries that pay very low wages is that they're countercyclical. When the labor market heats up and there's a lot of competition for workers, restaurants can't fill their openings. In the late 90s, instead of firing workers, restaurants were scrambling to find them. They could not fill their job openings. Instead, when the recession hit, Oregon's labor market turned south. What we've seen since is that restaurants have been, in fact, able to find workers and have experienced fairly rapid growth. Characterized in their own industry publication, the main ingredient characterized restaurant employment growth over the last year as being one of the true shining stars in Oregon's economy, growing while other industries fall. The industries that were impacted most in our recession were high-tech, construction, business services, industries not impacted by the minimum wage increase, but the industries most impacted, like the restaurant industry, have grown. And in fact, the Employment Department statistics on the retail sector that sells food, so essentially groceries, has seen an increase in 700 jobs over the last year. The job losses that we're talking about, even if we were to accept the opposition argument, don't add up to a large impact on Oregon's unemployment rate. We have the second highest unemployment rate in the country in the year 2002 for reasons that have nothing to do with Oregon's minimum wage. Even if we repeal the increases, which is not an issue here, we would see Oregon continue to have a high unemployment rate relative to other states because of other factors. And with that, I'll go ahead and stop and urge you to oppose 2624.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, for the record, I'm Bob Castagna representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. Today, the Oregon Catholic Conference joins Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, Lutheran Advocacy Ministry Office, and the Oregon Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America in stating its opposition to House Bill 2624. With welfare reform adopted at the federal level and at the state level a few years ago, there was the goal of moving people from welfare or public assistance to work. The other goal that was unstated but is a necessary part of that movement of people is to move people from welfare to work and out of poverty. Measure 25 is an attempt in increasing the minimum wage and attaching an inflation index to do that, to move people out of poverty, to at least keep them moving in the direction of the cost of living as the minimum wage moves up. With the state with the highest hunger rate in the nation, Measure 25, including its inflation index, appears to be, in what we would call in church social teaching, economic justice. When the bishops issued a pastoral letter on the economy, they basically framed economic decision-making and asked three questions to be attached to those type decisions. What does the decision do to the poor? What does it do for the poor? and how do the poor participate in it? We believe Measure 25 took the poor into consideration, an attempt to move people out of poverty by increasing their wages. With that, we would like to go on record and ask the committee to oppose House Bill 2624.
Thank you very much.
No.
Okay, Bridget Burns, is it Javier Valles? And let's see, we got let's say Cappy Eaton. Welcome. Thank you for coming and for patience on this serious, important matter.
And Mr. Chair, I just wanted the folks who are coming up now to testify to know that I have to go to another committee, and so did one of the other senators, so we're not ignoring you, but I'm in another four-person committee, and they need me.
This will be part of the record, and you have to submit written testimony to all the members of the minutes. Let's start.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bridget Burns, and I am a board member for the Oregon Student Association, and I am the president of the Associated Students of Oregon State University. Today I'm speaking in opposition to House Bill 2624 on behalf of OSA and the thousands of students that we represent who all work minimum wage jobs. Minimum wage jobs are essential to students who are working to attain a college education. A steady annual adjustment to the minimum wage is critical to ensuring that working students' income stays in line with their expenses. As students are facing tuition increases, increases in living expenses, and declining financial aid, many students are forced to take on jobs, while other students are increasing their hours to cover the costs. Many of the jobs that are available to students pay minimum wage. The gradual adjustment in minimum wage will ensure that thousands of students are able to afford the increased costs in post-secondary education. At a time when students are being asked to shoulder their share of the current budget crisis, it's important that we protect those students who are working to put themselves through school. Affordable and accessible post-secondary education leads to an educated workforce, increasing earning power and greater opportunities for employers and employees in our state. An indexed minimum wage is a factor in maintaining affordability for those students who are dependent on minimum wage jobs to get their education. We ask that you consider those students whose education is reliant upon minimum wage jobs. Oregon voters understand the importance of a minimum wage that can support all minimum wage employees, and then we ask that you uphold their decision. Oregon Student Association urges you to vote no on House Bill 2624 and continue to allow working students to afford an education and eventually give back to our state. Protect our students and protect our minimum wage. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Buenas tardes, me llamo Javier Velázquez. El compañero Javier Seja no pudo venir hoy porque tiene que trabajar, pero voy a leer el testimonio que él preparó.
Good afternoon, my name is Javier Velázquez. Javier Seja could not be present today because he is working. I'm going to read the testimony he's prepared.
Tengo aquí en los Estados Unidos más de 20 años trabajando en el campo y en estos trabajos casi siempre pagan lo mismo, el mínimo.
I've lived in the United States and worked in agriculture for over 20 years. In these jobs, they always pay you the absolute minimum.
Fue necesario el sueldo mínimo que subiera de 6.50 a 6.90, aunque yo diría que merecemos aún más.
It was necessary that the minimum wage rise from 6.50 to 6.90, although I would say that we deserve even more.
Como el sueldo estaba antes, no servía para mantener a mi familia. Les invito a los senadores y diputados a que vivan un tiempo con este sueldo para que vean lo difícil que es mantener a su familia.
The way the minimum wage was before, it wasn't enough to support a family. I invite the senators and representatives to live for a while with this wage so that they see how difficult it is to support one's family.
Lo que ellos siempre alegan es que solamente los jóvenes ganan el sueldo mínimo, o sea que no es gente que tiene que mantener a una familia, pero en realidad muchas personas que mantienen a una familia dependen de este sueldo, incluso hay madres solteras que necesitan este aumento para mantener a sus hijos.
Many say that it is only the young people who earn the minimum wage, that is, not people who need to support a family. But in reality, many people that support a family rely on this wage. There are even single mothers who need this raise to support their children.
La ley que dice que el sueldo mínimo va a aumentar cada año es una ayuda importante, pero no resuelve todo el problema. Por un lado hay sueldo mínimo, por otro lado hay sueldo actual, es decir, el poder de compra que uno tiene. Mientras el sueldo mínimo sube, el sueldo actual va bajando.
The law that says that the minimum wage will go up every year is an important help, but does not entirely resolve the problem. On the one hand, there's the minimum wage, and on the other hand, there's the real wage, that is, the buying power a person has. And while the minimum wage doesn't go up, the real wage goes down because the cost of everything else rises.
El sueldo actual baja por todos los costos suben. En años anteriores ya pagaban... Yo pagaba 40, 50 dólares de luz al mes en el invierno, pero ahora estoy pagando hasta 70 al mes. La gasolina ha subido hasta el doble, la renta ha subido, la aseguranza que uno tiene que tener según la ley también ha subido. Ese es el juego del capitalismo.
In previous years, I paid $40 or $50 a month for electricity in the winter, but now I'm paying up to $70 each month. Gas has almost doubled in price. Rent prices have risen. Insurance, which you must also have according to the law, has also gone up. That's the game of capitalism.
Respecto a lo que a los que dicen que habrá crisis en el sueldo mínimo que suba cada año, les contesto que habrá crisis si no sube, además el del sufrimiento de la gente que no tiene dinero para comprar las cosas más básicas. El hecho de que la gente consume menos va a perjudicar a la economía.
In response to those who say that there will be a crisis if the minimum wage goes up every year, I respond that there will be a crisis if it doesn't go up. In addition to the suffering of the people that don't have money to buy the most basic things, the fact that people consume less will hurt the economy.
Viendo la política del propio presidente Bush, al principio de su administración dio algún dinero por medio de las taxas para que la gente tuviera un dinero que gastar y se reanimara la economía. Cuando no sube el sueldo mínimo, la gente deja de comprar muchas cosas y recurre más a la ayuda social.
Look at what President Bush himself did at the beginning of his administration. He gave some money to people via tax cuts so that they'd have some money to spend and revive the economy. When the minimum wage doesn't go up, people stop buying many things and rely more on social assistance.
En Oregon y en su gran industria agrícola que ocupa muchos trabajadores, le pagan casi a todos el puro mínimo. Si no hay un aumento justo anualmente al sueldo mínimo, habrá mucha gente sin el dinero suficiente para pagar sus necesidades.
In Oregon, with its big agricultural industry that employs a lot of workers, almost all of them are paid the minimum wage. If there's not a fair annual raise in the minimum wage, there will be many people without enough money to cover their necessities.
Tiene mucho peso que el aumento del sueldo mínimo fue aprobado en una votación popular. No fue algo de recurrir a un grupo de políticos, sino que fue que la mayoría del pueblo que votó a favor, y hay que respetar esta decisión.
It should carry a lot of weight that the raise in the minimum wage was passed by a popular vote. It wasn't a matter of going to a group of politicians. On the contrary, it was the majority of the people that voted for it, and this decision must be respected.
Thank you very much.
And I also wanted to add that we submitted 4 written testimonies from other farm workers who couldn't be here today.
All right, we appreciate that. That'll be entered into the record.
Thanks.
Thank you all for coming.
Can I say something? Cassandra. Diles que se pudieran hacer este tipo de juntas ya por la tarde para que viniera gente campesina a escuchar estas audiencias.
Javier just wanted to explain that the reason that farm workers often cannot be present here is that during the days they're working and it's not until evenings that they have time, and obviously since they are earning the minimum wage, they generally can't afford to take a day off to be present here.
Thanks.
Thank you. And we do appreciate you coming. All right, let me get there. Okay, Marcia Kelly. Is Cappy here? Cappy Eden?
I can explain.
Okay. And have you heard from David Baker?
No.
Is David Baker here? You want to come up, David? And our last person, Joanne Weiss?
That's extra.
Weiser. Okay. Can't see that R. If all 3 of you just come up, that'd be great. And the chair had to step out to another meeting. So we're kind of doing musical chairs.
I understand.
Can you state your name for the record?
Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition, which includes the American Association of University Women, Delta Kappa Gamma, the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the YWCA of Salem, and Oregon's Older Women's League. We have probably close to 5,000 members across the state in very many places in the state. I think the testimony that you've heard from people who are working at the minimum wage is very compelling. We need to make sure that our families do not continue to live in poverty, and anything that we can do to help that is important. And in addition to that, the American Association of University Women and our other members feel very strongly about what the voters have told people. And when it's an initiative and it passes and it's passed after jobs have been lost in Oregon, when there is high unemployment, it is saying something to people. And so I just wanted to get us on the record in opposition to this bill. In addition, Kathy had to leave because she has 18 people coming for dinner at her house tonight. She wanted to point out the second paragraph in her written testimony, especially that Oregon is in a social policy crisis in terms of meeting the basic needs of its citizens, and opposition to this bill is preferred by the League of Women Voters.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And David?
Good afternoon, Senator Walker.
Can you state your name?
My name is David Baker. I'm the Outreach Director for Survivors Advocating for an Effective System, or SAFES. And SAFES is a Portland-based nonprofit organization of crime survivors who believe that the best solution to crime is prevention. So it may seem a little odd, then, that we're here today urging this committee to do everything it can against House Bill 2624, urging you not to repeal the voter-mandated cost-of-living adjustments to Oregon's minimum wage, because passing House Bill 2624 would cause more hardship than this committee may realize. You've heard other folks up here testifying about the numbers. One of the numbers that hasn't come up, and something that we understand very well, is that people living in poverty, according to federal statistics, are twice as likely to be victimized by crime as people living above the federal poverty level. And I think that's a number that bears repeating. People living at or below the poverty line in this country are twice as likely to be crime victims. We know, obviously, from previous testimony that, 73% of minimum wage earners are adults. 25% of them are family members. And we also just heard that 65 or 63% of the people who work full-time live in poverty. So for us, I mean, I could go on and on because the research is plentiful, but the lesson is clear. The pernicious problem of poverty with its intricate and inescapable links to crime and crime victimization is only going to be exacerbated by denying hardworking families even the smallest leg up. Nickels and dimes are what we're talking about here. And it might not seem like a lot to many, but to a family struggling to cover just the basics, 10 or 15 cents an hour, provided by the voter-approved increase in Oregon's minimum wage is huge. I know, SAFES knows, that this committee and this legislature is under significant pressure from various industry groups. And I sat through the testimony, and I've heard some compelling arguments. We understand that there are folks who've testified here that have said that increasing wages for workers is bad for business, or maybe more accurately, that paying folks less than a living wage is good for business. But in light of the fact that people who live at or below the federal poverty line are twice as likely to be victimized by crime, our question to you is, how can bad for people be good for business? And with that, I'll close and thank you for the time. And SAFES urges you and is on record opposing House Bill 2624.
Thank you. Ms. Weiser?
My name is Joanne Weiser, and I came as a citizen today. I represent myself and the majority of voters who passed this legislation very recently, and I'm concerned about what happens when voters see their will turned over because business interests are so able to bring lobbyists and voices to the fore. I think that we already have a lot of citizen disengagement, and I'd hate to see that increased by just negating what the voters have asked for. When we passed minimum wage law with automatic cost of living increases, we did so because we understand that these real increases hit those at the bottom of the income scale hardest. And we wanted their paychecks and their employers, not the social welfare system, to provide for those increased costs.
we are tired of seeing arguments about the minimum wage consume the legislature. It seems like it's something that should be pretty easily taken care of, and this legislation gives the opportunity to just take care of itself in the future. It doesn't need to be reconsidered. And we're proud to be citizens of a state that requires one of the highest minimum wages because it still is not a livable wage. Even though an employee is working full-time in the state without any vacation, they're still only going to make $14,000 a year. And if they get a 10-cent an hour increase, it will mean $208 a year. I mean, my increase in just my heating costs have been that. And if I said to my accountant, oh, yeah, I got a raise this year of $208, it would be a joke. And yet that is what we're talking about. It's unfathomable to me that the same people, the same trade organizations that came in here and talked about minimum wages will also be back here saying, don't tax capital gains anymore, don't tax dividends anymore. They don't even work. We don't even work for that income. And yet, decrease taxation, decrease the potential to make money for the people at the very bottom of the income level of earners. These same associations will be here talking to you about the estate tax. And we've already voted an increase of 520% over 9 years in how much money would pass unearned from one generation to another. And yet they're worried about a cost of living increase for people who aren't going to have any estates to pass. If Oregon's employees are to be self-sufficient rather than dependent upon government and public services for support, our minimum wage must make it possible to buy food, housing, transportation when the costs go up. I urge you to vote to say no to the powerful lobbyists who would leave Oregon's working citizens vulnerable, and yes to your voting constituents. Thank you.
I did, Senator Nelson. Thank you for asking.
Thank you very much for coming down. I realize that we're moving around, but this is a very important issue, and I appreciate your testimony. I don't have anybody else signed up, I don't think. Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to come up? Okay, thank you. I appreciate everybody coming in, and we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2625. Close the public hearing for the business.